Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Michael Anton with us, who has a book freshly out that we're going to talk about a lot today. Michael Anton, he's a lecturer now in politics and research, a fellow at the Hillsdale College's Kirby Center for Constitution Studies and Citizenship in Washington, D.C. He served as deputy assistant to President Trump, and he also served in other political and corporate roles in the last few decades. Senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. His writings have appeared, especially in the last few years. I'm hoping most of our audience is familiar with Michael Anton's name in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the Claremont Review of Books. You write for the magazine, also for the American Mind?
I actually haven't done anything for the American Mind yet.
Okay, yet.
So I'm sure I will at some point, but I've been in the magazine many times and in the online version of the magazine many times.
Right. You also wrote a book on the suit.
Yes.
Under a different name, Nicholas Antongiovanni.
Right.
In 2000, a Machiavellian approach to men's style.
Yeah, so, it's sort of a pastiche of a parody of the prince, borrows the structure and style and so on.
Very good. Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Mike Orchard. Now, this book, here's the title, After the Flight 93 Election, The Vote That Saved America and What We Still Have to Lose. The book reproduces the now famous Flight 93 election essay published 2 months before
my recollection is September 5th, 2016.
Right.
I know it was Labor Day.
And then there was a follow-up essay published here, and then you have an introduction, sort of a general, almost philosophical introduction. But maybe I should ask you about the genesis of this little book.
Well, there's three new things, and as you say, there's two things that have already been published, the Flight 93 election and what I call the restatement on Flight 93, which published about 8 days after the Flight 93 election, in which I sort of gathered up all of the, there was a lot of criticism. I read most of the prominent criticism, and I figured that rather than respond as one-offs, they all were saying essentially the same seven things, and I just responded to all of those seven things in the restatement. Roger Kimball, who runs Encounter Books and loved the essay, wanted to republish it, asked me to do this. And I thought, of course, we need some new material, and I thought about what it would be, and I happened to be working on essentially an outline of the political philosophy that I teach in the Claremont summer programs of the Publius and the Lincoln Fellows programs, and they wanted me to address, you know, a sort of what conservatism is supposed to be and how it lost its way. And I was writing up an outline of all the things we believe, a kind of creedal outline, and it turned out to be very long. And what you see is that in the new essay is an attempt to distill that. So there's really three new parts to the book. One is just a preface, introduces it, puts it in context, tells the story of how the Flight 93 election got written and so on. The second is a little self-indulgent, but I'm glad I got away with it. It's a fairly long explanatory note on the pseudonym that I chose for the Flight 93 election, because that has also been criticized, that people say, I don't understand the real meaning of Decius and what he meant in Livy and what he meant for Machiavelli. And so I explain at some length, and in fact, I think I do. No other publisher probably would have let me get away with that, so I'm really grateful to Roger. And then what I call the pre-statement on Flight 93, which is about, it's the longest of the new parts, and it's the most substantive part of the new part. And it sort of, it tries to explain, it's ambitious in a way for something that's only 10,000 words. I mean, I begin with moral and political epistemology. How do we know what we think we know about the good, the just, the true, the right? I give a kind of basically classical / medieval account of human nature and the basis of moral philosophy and political philosophy. And then I describe what the American founders, how they tried to meet these timeless challenges. I describe the scope, what I call the scope and limits of the American solution, meaning I know there have been attempts by conservatism, rather foolish and short-sighted attempts, to over-universalize the founders. They make universal claims, but they immediately qualify their universal claims with practical considerations and reservations, that this can't be operationally universalized instantly. So don't think that just because we've declared that all men are created equal, we're going to throw off the shackles of tyranny everywhere in the world instantaneously.
And that assumption, just quickly, this is what leads into various misadventures abroad.
Yeah, it leads to actually lots of things, including that. Then the book sort of starts to shift to how this all came apart. You know, we actually had it right. I think both philosophy had it right, it understood the soul accurately for about 2,200 years or so.
Not a bad run.
Not a bad run. And I think that, and lots of different philosophers in different traditions, in different languages, different countries, all had a kind of very similar understanding. I think the American founders basically got it right. And the things they didn't get right, they knew were wrong. You know, I don't buy into this notion that they believed in slavery or they thought it was a positive good. I don't go into this in detail in the book, but I do a little, you know, all of that emerges after the founding and it required correction, which we got. You know, when did it all start to go awry? And I explain how it came apart, right? Which I have a section that I call American Attacks and the American Solution.
Why is it that you say from the start, you had sort of constant attacks on the American solution to these things? Why?
Well, I would say that at least at the start, they weren't particularly effective attacks, but you have to disentangle this. So Rousseau is writing before the American, some of his books come out before the American Revolution. I think Social Contract didn't come out in 1776 or 5 or 4 anyway. But it's not like the founders were reading him and he had any influence on them. The people who had influence on the founders on the philosophic sense were Locke and Montesquieu above all, mm-hmm. Algernon Sidney to some extent. Jefferson has a famous letter late in his life when he says he was inspired by the elementary books of public right, and he cites four figures, two ancient and two modern, Aristotle, Cicero, Sidney, Locke, and then he has a little et cetera afterward, and others. We know that they read Montesquieu and were deeply impressed by Montesquieu because Montesquieu's quoted, actually more than any other author in The Federalist, Montesquieu's name appears. So you have attacks on it, I would say, first of all, because it was new. The American founders were trying to do something that had never been done. Mm-hmm. Second of all, they were obviously threatening the European order, which was a monarchical aristocratic order, and they threw off a king and called him illegitimate and said, we're not going to be your subjects anymore. So that shakes the foundations of every other monarchy in Europe, contemplating this as a possibility for themselves. The French, you could say cynically or unwisely or imprudently or whatever, we were grateful for their help in the American Revolution, but they were doing that to stick it to their historic enemy, the English, and probably weren't thinking in 1776 through 1783 that the time would shortly come when their own monarchy, partly inspired by the American Revolution, would fall. Mm-hmm. So there are threads that attack the solution that I just name quickly and I don't go into, such as, I say, you know, Rousseauian romanticism, Hegelian historicism, the throne and altar right, fascism. I focus on the American attacks because they're American, because they were the most effective, because they were near, and because everything in the three waves of American liberalism in one form or another is still with us. So what I say the three strands that attacked the founder solution was first, sort of Calhounism, for lack of a better term, which was an attack on the founding precisely in order to preserve slavery. Mm-hmm. It was defeated in almost every sense, obviously militarily, politically, and mostly intellectually, but a very important part of Calhoun's thought, which he calls the concurrent majoritarianism. It's a way for a sort of a permanent minority, a political minority in a pluralistic society that operates via majority rule to constantly get its way against majority rule. That's what Calhoun was essentially seeking as a protection for slavery, because he looked out and he knew that slavery subjected to a vote nationwide was going to lose, and if it wasn't going to lose today. Remember, Calhoun died in 1852, I think, maybe even 1850. So he's dead before the Civil War starts. But he could see in the 1830s a future in which the South would simply no longer have the political support nationwide to keep slavery going, and they would lose votes. And so he came up with a theory to make legitimate minority sort of insistence on certain policies against majority will.
Do we see
another very simple way to put that is group rights, which you hear a lot about today.
I was going to say
completely alien to the American founding, and I think the nerve of it is found in Calhoun. And I even read some journal articles that I don't quote where people examining, you know, proportional voting and the concept of the concurrent majority in European systems say this is actually an idea, one of the few ideas that the Europeans imported from the Americans and not the other way. And it comes ultimately from Calhoun.
One of the mechanisms is a swing vote. A group that can function as a swing vote?
It's not so much that. It's to say that if you're whatever you are, if you're 20% or 30% or 15% of the population, there are certain non-negotiables on which you can't be outvoted, and you get to have your way no matter what. Now, the founders would say, of course, there are non-negotiables. Majority rule is always consistent with minority rights. And the regime is based on a conception of natural rights that are natural, that the government exists to secure and protect, but that are not granted by the government. They're granted by God and nature. And if a well-functioning government secures and protects them, an incompetent government doesn't, and a tyrannical government, you know, runs roughshod over them. So they would agree to that extent. But what they would not say is that there could be specific policies that if majority will disliked, that the minority could hold on to forever, even after being outvoted. So for the founders, I think, you know, Lincoln actually proves this in the famous Cooper Union speech, his most intellectually challenging speech of all time, which he gave in February of 1860. Here in New York City, actually pretty close to this office building.
Blocks down,
And it was a reply to Douglas, Stephen Douglas, his likely, you know, Lincoln was not yet the nominee, but probably going to be the nominee. And Douglas had said that, well, on this question of slavery and the expansion of slavery in the territories, we should do exactly as the founders did. We should not, you know, I'm the real conservative and he's the radical. So what did Lincoln do? He went back and he checked the record on every vote that in the founding era taken on whether slavery could be prohibited from a federal territory. I'm not going to go into it at length, read it, it's fabulous, but just one example is the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which acquires land that became the Midwest, Ohio, and so on, Wisconsin, up into Michigan. And before there is a U.S. functioning U.S. Constitution, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787 says there will not be slavery in this federal territory. No state can organize itself. There won't be slaves here. So Lincoln, case by case, he proves that people who signed the Declaration, who signed the Constitution, were also voted for restrictions of slavery in federal territories, and he shows that he's the one being more faithful to the founders than Douglas is. So in other words, I think that the reason I brought up the Cooper Union speech is what the position Calhoun wanted to say is no matter what the dominant, even if the dominant majority in the United States of America became 85% anti-slavery or anti-slavery expansion and 15%, we as our concurrent minority get to keep it no matter what. Founders would not have agreed with that. Right? They would have said the only thing you get to keep is your rights. That's the thing majority will can never trample on or abridge. Mm-hmm. Comes to a massive political and moral question like this, the majority will, so long as it is you know, in order to be reasonable, has to be rightful. As long as it is rightful, it will prevail. That's that concept of group rights is what we are seeing now on the left.
This applies immediately to today, mm-hmm. with the group rights. Can be more specific about how it operates today, and perhaps how the 2016 election threatened that trend.
So that's the first wave of what I call the American attacks. The second attack, I'll just state, name it, and we can move on. It's capital P progressivism, known as the administrative state and a sort of rule by experts. And the third wave is. I describe it in the book as a kind of synthesis of Rawlsian liberalism and new left identity politics, which emerge at the same time. In, let's say, I think Theory of Justice is published in 71. The new left obviously is born, with, you could say, in 62 with the Port Huron Statement, but it starts to take on the real hard edge of identity politics in the late 60s, early 70s. A paper by my friend David Azarad that he wrote recently for the Heritage Foundation. He did research, he carefully researched this, and he found the first ever document, as far as he knows, or anybody's been able to find, in which the phrase identity politics is used as a positive signifier for a group. They say, this is what we practice. And I think, I forgot the date, but it was also in the early 70s. Hmm. So I sort of trace those two things and how they came to be combined, Rawlsian liberalism and identity politics.
Has he published this?
It's out. It's been out for about a month. It's online.
Okay.
And I say that's the liberalism, that's the leftism that we live with today, and I describe how it operates.
This is a very powerful rhetorical and political weapon for that group.
Mm-hmm. And or coalition of groups, you might say.
And they sensed very early on that of all the Republican candidates in the primaries, this guy is the problem.
Right. There's so many reasons, but let's sticking to the things that I talk about in the book.
Well, in the book you say, Trump is liberal in many ways. Why does the left hate him so much?
Well, for one thing, the ways in which he's liberal or more centrist are in economic policy. He's much closer to a mid-century Democrat on trade and doing things that actively help the working class and blue-collar workers. And, you know, frankly, although I was pleased to see him come out forthrightly against socialism in the State of the Union, there's a little bit of a redistributionist edge to him, where not in a bad way. It doesn't. Yeah. I'm not concerned about it. If anybody's paying attention, if you're conservative and you're paying attention, you should realize that massive income inequality and wealth inequality growth over the past 30 years. It hasn't worked out well from conservative, and all the people with money are your enemies and they hate you and they want you dead. If you haven't figured that out yet, you're just an idiot and you probably can't be woke enough. Sorry to be
indeed.
Blunt.
Indeed. No, look, but it's, look, you know, things have reversed, and a whole lot of people haven't quite realized that.
No, they're still. I still read. So, not to get slightly off topic. Not long ago, Liberty Law site asked me to write something about Silicon Valley, which is near where I grew up. I didn't grow up there, but I grew up sort of around it and driving through it, and so on. So, I'm fairly familiar with it, and my parents are still there. And I wrote a piece. And the typical, you know, and then what they do is they have other people comment on it. And I knew exactly what I was going to get, and I got exactly what I thought I was going to get, which is the typical conservative mash notes to how brilliant and innovative, and, you know, the tech billionaires are, and how they're the spirit of entrepreneurialism, and this is true conservatism, and I am an economic ignoramus, and I don't know anything. And I just thought, you guys are just, I wrote a fairly pointed reply to them that's up at the Liberty Law site, which one can read if one wants. I just thought, you guys are completely out of it. You don't really know what you're talking about. And you don't know what, they certainly don't know what the tech billionaires think of them, which I told them pointedly. They basically consider you a gnat, and they don't care about you, the mash notes that you write to them. They don't read them. It's like sending a beautiful cheerleader, a Valentine every day for 365 days. Every single one of them goes in the garbage can unread, and you keep doing it thinking that you're getting somewhere.
Are the conservatives who still don't apprehend how our situation has changed, are they still, who is supporting them at this point? I mean, I think you put it at one point in one of your pieces at American Greatness, did you say, how many times does Bill Kristol have to be wrong before we stop listening to
him? I don't
think
I said that. One of the other guys must have.
Okay.
I just, despite being really nastily attacked by Bill Kristol over the past 2.5 years and ongoing, I have not responded to him at all until I have I mentioned him once in my brand new review in the Claremont Review of Books, which is a review of John Marini's book. And it's telling, one of Kristol's most, it's hard to say what his most disgraceful tweet would be, but this certainly would be up there. When, remember, about a year ago or so, he said, between the Trump state and the deep state, I'll take the deep state.
Right.
So this is a supposed constitutionalist conservative who, studied with one of the greatest conservative scholars of the last 50 years, Harvey Mansfield, and was supposed to have learned something about the Constitution and American principles and how it works. And he basically said, I'm all for the undemocratic administrative state / deep state rule of experts, all the things that I learned to be against and wrote against and founded a magazine to be against over my life. Yeah. I'm just tossing all of that aside in one tweet. I thought, wow, what an extraordinary admission.
I've admired Bill Kristol for a long, long time, and I look at Bill Kristol for the last couple of years with just puzzlement.
Yeah.
I wouldn't denounce him. I'm just baffled, actually, about what's going on there. I'm not sure I have any explanation for it. But to get back about our situation and what Trump represented. You started out by being part of this anonymous website,
mm-hmm.
Journal of American Greatness.
Yep.
Start it because of Trump's candidacy, or had you already started to conceive?
No, it was definitely because of Trump's candidacy. So when he took the famous escalator ride, I thought, here we go again. I remembered 2012 when he said he was running all throughout that sort of non-primary primary season, the middle of the year before the election, and then he dropped out before any of the real action started. And I thought, he's going to do that again. That's what he does. I paid no attention to him. And he kept insisting, and a lot of people were making that point to him or about him in the media, and he kept insisting, I'm serious, I'm running, I'm not dropping out this time.
No one took him seriously.
And it took me a while to take him seriously. Eventually, sometime in the fall, I started to take him more seriously and listening to what he was saying, realized that he had what I thought were the right issues. And then I finally pitched to the CRB. I said, I want to write an article about why he's the best candidate among the 17 before a vote was cast. They agreed to that. I wrote it. Then they hemmed and hawed. They took a long time, which they don't usually do.
Yeah,
and they came back and said, we can't publish this.
Things are moving quickly. We got to publish quickly. I mean, at that time.
So it was weeks before they turned it down. And I was disappointed. And it turned out that I made an acquaintance with a guy who was in kind of the same boat. He had written one piece for the Weekly Standard that they published that I saw and I was impressed by. And then he wrote another one, which was even better, that they didn't publish, sort of seeing Trump through the lens of James Burnham in managerialism. They didn't publish. And I just happened to be at dinner with him and some other people one night in like early February. And I mentioned that I had this great thing that, or I thought it was great anyway, yeah. that had not been published. And I had seen his thing because he had shown it to me. And he just said, well, we're going to start something new. And he started it. And I just started running with it. We had a great fun for about 4 months. I think it got noticed, maybe got more noticed than we had anticipated or wanted. We were I think elsewhere and doing other things, and we didn't.
I remember, was it one op-ed by Peggy Noonan who said, the most interesting right now on all of what's going on is in this little Journal of American Greatness
website. That was the one that really spiked the traffic a lot, and so the gang decided to pull the plug in June of 2016. And I thought I was done and I was never going to do any more again. And
the summer goes on. Labor Day arrives and you say,
Before that. It was, I started to stew and just think, I've got more to say. Actually, so after rejecting the original piece, eventually Charles Kessler sent me an email asking, well, he says, we're going to do a lot of web-only content about the election. Do you want to weigh in? And I said, no, I don't. I think, I put this behind me and just get back to my regular life. And then a couple of weeks went by, I thought, maybe I do.
Michael, in those weeks, you didn't start getting a little exercised, seeing the what seemed to be the Hillary momentum, the attacks on Trump, from conservative sides.
Well,
as,
I hate to say
well.
This, but I basically always took it for granted that he was going to lose.
I
thought the
so
electoral map was so against him, and all the odds so against him, with your own party divided and all of its luminaries attacking you. I thought it was hopeless. I thought he deserved to win, but I thought the obstacles were so insurmountable that he couldn't win. So at first, I tried not to let it bother me, and then it did bother me, and then enough pent up frustration becomes the Flight 93 election. Which I didn't think would do anything. I honestly didn't even think anyone would care about it.
You note here in your follow-up piece, maybe I get the same little audience that I got on the website, but then Rush Limbaugh reads it over the air. Word for word, he read the whole thing?
Pretty much, yeah. So it was published with the pseudonym, so my thought process was, nobody reads anything with a pseudonym, because half the reason you read anything is because you know who wrote it, right? If it just says X, who cares? But if it says, brilliant intellectual Y or scurrilous jerk Z, then you're interested because of who it is. And I said, B, if you recognize Decius as a pseudonym, it means you've already read, the only way you would is because you've already read the Journal of American Greatness. And then you'd read this and say, he said everything in here on the Journal of American Greatness, so who cares? This is just a rehash. This poor repetitive man can't think of anything new to say. So that's what I thought would be the two responses to it.
But it took off. It took off. And I think that if it did contain a lot of things that you'd already said, the rhetorical upping of the ante here, I mean, from the metaphor, the Flight 93 election, I'll just read to our readers the opening. 2016 is the Flight 93 election. Charge the cockpit or you die. You may die anyway. You or the leader of your party may make it into the cockpit and not know how to fly or land the plane. There are no guarantees, except one: if you don't try, death is certain. To compound the metaphor, a Hillary Clinton presidency is Russian roulette with a semi-auto. With Trump, at least you can spin the cylinder and take your chances. I think you got people. Right there. That needed to be said. If we're going to go down, then we got to realize, we have to go down fighting, at least. And that's why you bring up the Themos and the Virtue.
For which I was criticized roundly for recommending an immoderate and dangerous politics. And as I make the point in the restatement, as I said at a lunch presentation on the book yesterday, the crazy, radical, immoderate thing I was actually urging people to do was, now wait for it, this is going to shock everyone listening, vote.
Exactly.
Right? So I didn't say pick up your guns. I didn't say storm the barricades. I didn't say reenact 1848 or even 1776. We would like to be able to avoid that if possible. But if the left keeps winning and keeps turning the screw the way they're turning the screw, they're either one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to produce a backlash, which could be very, very ugly, or they're going to become tyrants and we're going to be subsumed under their rule. And that's also very ugly. I don't like either of those alternatives.
And had the right, the establishment right, become so establishmentized that they forgot the other side has a whole lot of thymos and virtue. They've got the passion. They have the power. They have the conviction, and they're ready to fight.
I think two things, I mean more than two, but the two things I would mention right now that are fundamentally wrong with the establishment right is one, they're not really conservative anymore. They're not conserving things that need to be conserved. And related, they long ago mistook or misapprehended policy for principle. So to them, free trade is a principle. To them, low taxes is a principle. For them, you know, school choice is a principle. These are all first principles. They're not first principles. What I wrote in that book are the first principles as I learned them. And I think this is perhaps arrogant. I consider myself not a discoverer of anything. I am a formulator, synthesizer. I say at the beginning of the pre-statement, this is not a philosophical treatise, it's a political argument, right? If you want to know the deep underlying currents that I'm trying to summarize, you've got to go to the source. You've got to go to Aristotle, you've got to go to Cicero, Sidney Locke, Montesquieu, etc. Mm-hmm. But I am trying to summarize those things in a way that no one who is not genuinely conservative, whether they're religious conservative or philosophic conservative or whatever, everybody should be able to read that and go, yes, of course. Of course that's the basis for morality. Of course there is human nature. Of course virtue is a real phenomena that simply because it isn't amenable to empirical validation by peer-reviewed science doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Of course it exists. All of this stuff is true. We ought to be able to all agree on that. And what I say to my critics on the right, none of whom, from what I can tell, on the pseudo-right or the faux right, none of whom, as far as I can tell, have reviewed the book or treated the substance in it, I would be delighted to see people come out basically against natural right. Let's have a show of hands of professional conservative activist pundits and think tankers raise their hand and say, I don't believe, Anton is all wrong, I don't believe in natural right. Or, well, now that Anton has come out for natural right, I'm going to turn against it. Fine, great, let's see. Let's have that honest moment.
Why don't they?
I don't know. They probably don't. They're not going to bother to read it.
It's not part of their routine.
They're not going to bother to read it because I'm too anathema to them.
Well, I want to. We've got a few more minutes, and what I want to do is make sure that people understand you, because so much of your visibility has been really involved in your battles with the establishment conservative, pseudo-conservative intellectuals. But let's be clear about your understanding of where the real problem lies. And I'm going to quote from near the end of one of the original parts, The Choice We Face Now, the section. But by far the most sinister feature of post-1960s leftism, the one that feeds all the others, is the spiritual sickness, the self-loathing and existential despair with which it has infected the formerly confident and capable West. Mm-hmm. That's your real aim. This we've got to do something about the spiritual sickness that originates with the left now, and it has infected much of the right. But this is where we have to ultimately go.
I mean, we were talking, I think, before the tape started to record about Tucker Carlson's show. Well, one of the things that he's been very merciless on, rightly so, is the opioid epidemic. I think there are many other outgrowths, but the opioid epidemic is a product of that spiritual sickness. People don't feel like they have a future anymore, like their country has a future, their civilization has a future. We've seen life expectancies actually shorten in this age when medical advances haven't gone backward. The GDP hasn't yet gone down, although incomes have gone down or stagnated and so on. But like, why is life expectancy in certain populations going down?
People aren't having as many children.
People aren't having as many, of course. I think it all stems from that. And I've written something new that hasn't yet been published. We'll see if it gets published because it's a little edgy. But one of the things I said in there, I actually said this as an email to a friend that I sent it to and had him read it. And I just said, here's the summary of this piece. If you can't stand up to a mob coming after you saying you don't deserve to live and respond to them, yes, I do, and defend yourself, then you're dead already.
And do you want to defend yourself or not?
My correspondent said, you got to put that in there. I said, okay, sure. I'll put that in there.
Look, I mean, I think this is ultimately why President Bush's label, low energy, Jeb, worked.
Yeah, Fred Trump.
People sensed that we need strength at this point. And however much we admire Jeb Bush, well, whatever, one way or the other, he doesn't have it.
Yeah.
To combat what we see coming from the other side. And you want to say things like, you guys were surprised by the Kavanaugh hearings? If you were surprised that all of that show trial and everything, where have you been?
Right.
Where have you been?
Although I admit to having been a little surprised. I mean, the ferocity of it and the flimsiness of it. The prosecutor who they put in the worst possible position where she could only ask questions for 5 minutes and then had to stop and wait and then 5 minutes. If you paid attention to the questions she actually asked and the answers she got, she was devastating. She poked millions of holes in her credibility. Go back and compare that to the straight up he said, she said of Anita Hill. Anita Hill, I don't believe Anita Hill either, and I greatly admire Clarence Thomas, but Anita Hill was a significantly more credible witness to me. At the time, that just means, you know, in my own personal opinion, it means she's a better liar. But just the last minute and the flimsiness of it and just all the transparent lies and contradictions that the staff members and everybody got caught up in. And yet we were all supposed to pretend like this was serious rather than just a completely transparent, foolish, flimsy attempt to destroy someone for political purposes.
Well, this is how...
Now, I understand why somebody like Charles Grassley and Mitch McConnell had to say, we take this very, very seriously. And right. I would take, of course, any accusation seriously. But it's once you actually take it seriously and you look at it, do you still have to take it seriously when it's completely full of holes and it looks transparently ridiculous? You take it seriously when it's made. You don't take it seriously after you've examined it and you've seen it for what it is.
This is why you have your subtitle, The Vote That Saved America, and what we still have to lose.
We still have to lose is in a way described in the new section, although it's been eroded dramatically and greatly. It's not yet gone. And if we're going to live, we have to get it back. I don't see any other. As I said, if this project, I say this in the restatement, if this project continues, there's really only two. I list four in there. I won't go into them all because some of them are related. But fundamentally, it comes down to two. Either it will produce a backlash because, you know, if there is nature, which I believe,
Nature wins.
There is nature.
Eventually.
You eventually will bump up against natural limits and nature will rebel. If there isn't nature, then I'm just wrong about everything. The left was right about everything. It would either mean that I'm wrong about everything, Plato and Aristotle were wrong about everything, or I don't understand Plato and Aristotle. But that would also mean a lot of other people who understand them the same way I do don't understand them either. Or, you know, there is nature, it'll produce a backlash. Or, you know, Leo Strauss brought up the possibility in his book On Tyranny of the frightening possibility of a tyranny that he said would be perpetual and universal.
This is the greatest fear.
Yeah.
I think
Strauss was being a little coy there. He knows nothing human can be perpetual. But what he did mean to say was something that lasts a lot longer than Pisistratus or Pisistratus. I can't remember how to pronounce the Greek name, or the 30 tyrants in Athens. You know, it'll feel perpetual if it's going on for, you know, 70 years, that's the Soviet Union, maybe it goes on 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, who knows? That's a really long time. And that would be pretty bad. I still think in the end they will bump up against natural limits. And the question is when. You know, we don't want that to be, nobody wants to suffer or have civilization suffer under a tyranny of great, great, great length. And what does the bumping up consist of? Because things can get really ugly when societies unravel.
That's right. Everyone, the book is, I'm going to give you the title again, After the Flight 93 Election, The Vote That Saved America and What We Still Have to Lose. It's with Encounter Books. Mm-hmm. And so, Michael, thank you.
Thank you.